Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 19th of March, 2012, and we're honored to be joined on the line by our regular weekly guest, Bob Chapman of TheInternationalForecaster.com. Bob Chapman, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, let's get right into it today with an email that I just got from a listener who wanted to ask this question specifically about a talk that we were having a couple of weeks ago on the EU collapse. And the email reads, can you please ask Bob Chapman why he said a couple of weeks ago in your interview that if the EU collapses, that signals the end of the New World Order? Hope springs eternal, but please ask him specifically what he thinks these psychopaths will do after that, because I find it really hard to believe that they would just give up. And that's from Steve. So let's put that question to you. I think it's one that I tried to press you on the other week, and I think we got an answer, but let's put it out there again. What is the long-term after the EU collapses, and do you think that's just going to be the end of the New World Order?
Well, I think you have to return to the genesis of what this is all about and how power is held and manipulated. And that power that wants to become a new world order, it emanates from the banking community throughout the world. And that is the key to their power base. Now, if the euro goes down, and there's a 50-50 chance of that, and if that happens, this currency will allow all of the participants to return to their previous currencies of national origin. Now, these people in banking, finance, they've been working on this project for a long, long time. And we're only seeing the work that's been done since World War II. And so we look at it in a microcosm of what it really is. Yes, if the euro were to fail, that would send these people back to the drawing board. The problem is the status financially of the sovereign nations involved, as well as in England and the United States, is absolutely dreadful. And I don't know that they know how to fix it. Now, it's the easy way out is to allow it to degenerate, and then all of a sudden we find that they can't control it anymore. In fact, they're on the edge of that right now. And they have another war. Now, how that turns out remains to be seen. Will, quote, the war be won by these people and the people who work for them, we'll call it. And even if they do win, will they still be able to control power that emanates from finance? And it's a big question. And I don't think they can do it. I think that there's going to be so many people in this world who understand what's going on, the real going on, that I think they're going to demand that these people step down or be removed or whatever case. And I think that's on the way. Now, presently, if I had to guess how many people understand going on behind the scenes, I think it varies from country to country. I think the understanding is greater in Europe than it is in the United States, and always have. Because in living there, I would ask people questions along these lines over the years. Say, well, what do you think about that, these people controlling things? I say, well, it's always been that way. We know that. And we let them do what they want to do, and occasionally we have war. And that's the price that we have to pay for some sort of semblance of order in our societies. So they're well aware that there's this hand behind the scenes that runs things. So, if we leave out the third world, probably 15% of the people in the first two levels we'll call it the first and second worlds. They understand. Is that enough to bring these people on the carpet, so to speak? I think so. I think it is. And as you know, in change in history, you really don't need more than 5% of the people to do what they have to do to make something happen, something different than what is going on already. So I think that they're going to lose control. I think they already have in part. The countries supporting the euro, which are Finland, Holland, and Germany, all are starting to have what you might call financial problems. Last week I did a couple of columns and brought up the fact that the subsidies that have been given over the last, we'll call it eight years rather than 10, to these countries have caused growth rates to drop by 1.5-2% in places like Holland. And plus, they keep on piling up debt. And Germany's the same. In the last 8 years, Germany spent $300 billion a year subsidizing. Well, 3/8 of 24, that's $2.4 trillion. That's a lot of money. And are they willing to continue? The government say yes. The people say no. And in April and May, in France, we have elections coming up. The two major candidates, one's as bad as the other. And so I see no great change there, but France is losing its grip on its economy. It's headed downward, and it's not good. Then you have the scandal of Mr. Sarkozy receiving $70 million from Mr. Gaddafi, who he was quite happy to have dispatched into another world. And she shows you what allegiance these people have to one another. I think Holland will probably win. And I think the main reason, more than anything else, is that you're going to have, pulling out Sarkozy's coattails, the Front National. And they've dropped all of their objectives except two. They want to leave the euro and the European Union. And, of course, Mr. Sarkozy is a one-worlder, and he's just the opposite. Mr. Holland has said relatively the same thing. That could cause great changes in Europe if that happens. In other words, let's go back to our own currencies. We're sick of supporting everybody. That would be six countries. And that's really where they're at. And from a financial standpoint, they cannot continue to do what they're doing. I mean, you can't bail out Spain and Italy for $4 trillion. You just don't have it. You print it, you've got inflation. Europe is very, very negative on inflation, much more than anyone else. Others tolerate it, but they don't. And they're looking for 2%, a real percent. And so they strive towards that end. They're not going to get that. How can you get that when the European Central Bank system lent $1.4 trillion by the Federal Reserve, 800 banks took that money down. 800 banks. Now, all of them aren't bankrupt, but a lot of them are. And this supposedly bolsters their balance sheet. And, of course, they're all carrying two sets of books and the whole game that is played. But I think down the line here, we're going to see Greece, the money that they're going to receive in the second bailout is hardly enough to make a difference. They're going to get another bailout, and that's not going to come. And so the next step is Greece will go down and default, and they'll be followed by Ireland and Portugal. And it's probably a good thing for the Eurozone participants because they don't want to pay for them anyway. And so I think that's where it's headed. And then the big choice comes, do we keep the euro among the, quote, stronger group of nations, or do we go back to our own currencies? And I think probably they'll go back to their own currencies. Having what one would call a northern euro is possible. Is it probable? I don't think so. I think Germany wants to go on their own way. I think they want to be their own man, so to speak. And that's been coming for a long time. It's been over 60 years since the Second World War. They paid their dues after the war, I think. Of course, I guess in war, nothing ever gets really paid. And I think you all know what I mean. But I think where that's going is to a breakup of the euro. And that would put those who want world government in an even more defensive position. The only two options are they either get to find a way to fix it up so it functions, the financial situation in Europe, or they got to have a war. And now it's being talked about in the terms that I'm talking about. Lots more people are saying, gee, you know, they did have all these wars, and that's probably the reason why. And you have more and more people talking about it. So I think you put it all together, you'll see that the most fortuitous and easy way out is to go back to your own currencies, sort out your own debt, do your own thing, and what trade arrangements they can arrange is up to them. There may be none. I mean, Germany's had tremendous advantages, and I think that's going to come to an end, and I think they know that. They think they can make it on their own, and they probably can. So, I think what we've got to look forward to in Europe is an immediate end to the dream of world government. They've blown it. The whole underside structure of the edifice for world government has not worked. One interest rate fits all, no constitution, the disbursement of people among different nations from other nations, virtually none. It's been a natural association of people who have nothing in common with one another, except perhaps commerce. And that's it. So it's coming. And it's not the first time they failed. And it's not the last time unless we can remove their control of the financial area worldwide.
Well, then let's not leave it hanging there. I mean, obviously, the next question is how do we do that, considering the entire financial system has been created from the ground up from the architects of this entire plan for, I mean, going back centuries, if not millennia, when you start looking at the banking system itself. I mean, it has been there for a long time, and it's difficult to really imagine alternatives. What do you think is really the alternative we can do to try to rout the bankers out of control?
I think they're doing it themselves. You have the situation that we just discussed in Europe. The situation is worse in England. I mean, 2 weeks ago, they come out and told us that the country's broke. Now, there's only three times in history, 1694 and the formation of the Bank of England, that England has proposed to sell 100-year bonds, which are an absolute loser. And they're talking about it because they have no money. Now, who's going to buy them? I really don't know, but that's what they're shooting for. And they wouldn't be talking about it unless they talked to others already about those bonds. So I think that's how they think they're going to finance themselves. Whether they'll be successful or not, I really don't know. In the United States, they do quantitative easing, Operation Twist. And, of course, so we have deficits. In less than 3 years, the short-term U.S. government deficit has gone from 10.6 to $16.5 trillion. And we still have an economy in the doldrums. I don't think that's working very well, because they've spent all their time, as they have in Europe and England, saving the financial system. They've done nothing about having a recovery. They'll tell you that. But in order to do that, what you have to do is supply funds for small and medium-sized industry. They get 70% of the jobs. And you have to fund them in a way that they create those jobs. It's not being done. And so you kind of throttle the engine down to neutral. And you're sitting in the water, if you're in a boat, wondering, gee, what am I going to do next? And that's really the bottom line.
It certainly is, but I think one of the, well, perhaps hopeful things that you point to both there and also in the latest edition of The Forecaster is the idea that the people, I mean, certainly are not willing to go along with this, and this is why they're bending over backwards to make sure that the people don't have any say in any of these things, not only the people of the Netherlands, but of course we saw last year with the people of Greece being denied the referendum they were promised, and all of the incredible lengths that these people are willing to go to exclude any type of people's voice from the political process. And one has to imagine that there's only so much of that the people will be willing to take. I mean, even a zombified, fluoridated public will start rising up at some point. And they already have, of course, in Greece and in other places in Europe. So one imagines it. I mean, it's really just a matter of time until the people really do prevent them from going any further with this agenda.
Well, politically, it looks like people, as they always have historically, are going to for Britain circuses. And that's the incumbent. When you spend that kind of money with no way to pay it back to keep the economy going sideways, so to speak, without helping unemployment, and, you know, the past week, he stood up and said, look, I've saved you. Look at the economy. The Dow Jones is ready to go higher, and things look wonderful, and you should be like me. Besides, you know, we've got all these 50 million people on food stamp, and we have extended unemployment, and we continue to fully fund Medicaid. And it goes on and on. Look at the people on disability. I mean, if anything was ever a phony, for the most part, that is. People would just saying they get this and that wrong with them, and they get disability from Social Security. Our veterans coming home from the wars have to fight to get something like that. And the ne'er-do-wells in society, for whatever reason, have a big helping hand from the president. And who knows that as conservative of the as the two front runners in the Republican nomination are concerned, who knows what they're going to do? They've always acted the same way the Democrats have. So I think we're going to get more of the same. And in addition to that, probably peacetime martial law of one form or another. So they can keep track of everybody and make sure that they can control them. And I think this is where it's headed. I don't think unemployment's going to get any better. Real estate's going to continue to go down somewhat. And the economy will be taken sideways. I believe that they can do that through quantitative easing, but it's temporary. But they don't mind. They throw more money in the system, and most of it ends up on Wall Street, and then they gamble with it. That's why the market's up. It has nothing to do with reality. They just got more money than they know what to do with, and they can leverage it 100-to-1 if they choose. Right now, the leverage is running around 30-to-1. And that includes all players. But I think that you're going to see an extension of what you've seen, only worse. Financially, inflation-wise, as far as new rules and regulations are concerned, you know, there's always another executive order around the corner. And that's going to continue. They're going to bypass Congress, who are going to sit around and get paid off.
Well, I think you're not too far out on a limb to say that regardless of whether Romney or Santorum get anointed as the head of the GOP and the front runner for the presidential nomination, it's not going to make any iota of difference, even if they should defeat Obama, because it's all just a political sideshow, as we are all too familiar with. But you do raise the question of peacetime martial law, and I think it's an important point to flesh out a little bit, because it's one that I've made in the past, that if the acts that have been taken during the at least the Bush and Obama presidencies do not constitute a type of peacetime martial law, I'm really flabbergasted. I'm at a total loss to imagine what could be with the signing of the NDAA and all of these presidential proclamations of the power to be able to use the military assets on American citizens and preventive detentions and locking people away without trials. I mean, if that's not the very basic framework for martial law, I can't imagine what would be. I think the only thing that's left to happen in that piece of the puzzle is for roundups to begin. But I think we don't even need to see that to be able to declare that martial law already exists if the framework for it is already set up so intricately.
They changed all the rules. Posse comitatus doesn't exist anymore. And again, they do what they want. And if they can't get through Congress, they just have another executive order. So I think ultimately, and I don't know what the time frame is, people are going to get fed up. They're not going to have jobs. And in time, they're probably going to have to cut Social Security and Medicare. There's going to be a lot of unhappy people out there. And I think the lack of ability to be able to project what's going to happen and what can happen as far as anything approaching the kind of living conditions that people had in America prior to all this over the last several years. I think that if we go through this elections see relatively no change. What change there is only for the worst. I think you're really sitting on the edge of the frying pan and you're looking for revolution.
Well, let's examine the issue of world government from a different perspective, because of course there is the boots on the ground martial law hard force version of the implementation of world government. There's also the left cover version, which continues to move along apace despite, well, just overwhelming odds. They continue trotting it out every so often. And the most egregious example that I probably have seen to date just occurred earlier this week when Scientific American released a new editorial, "Effective World Government Will Be Needed to Stave Off Climate Catastrophe." And I cannot stress enough how much the listeners should go and actually take a look at this article so that they can actually believe what's being spouted by so-called scientific, so-called American. But just absolutely, unfortunately, the theme of world government in the name of the climate catastrophe that they're assuring us is going to occur in the next 50 or 100 or however many years into the future they want to put it, is unfortunately, it's just not an idea that's dying away, even though we've seen so much of the public reject the idea of catastrophic warming from CO2. So, Bob, what's your take on this and how this feeds into sort of a technocratic dictatorship that they've been trying to set up for decades now, where the scientists will tell everyone how to live their life and this is the way that we should run society from now on?
Well, you know, you got all kinds of things going on at the same time, but the direction is clear: totalitarian government. And totalitarian government today, in America, at least from my viewpoint, is corporatist fascism, just another deviance from socialism and communism. And they're all bad. And I think from the very beginning, this is what they wanted to use. And for many, many years, people thought it would be communism. But, and some of the people involved are communists. The president of the United States is a communist. But that's neither here nor there. The majority of where they're headed is corporations controlling government, the elimination of competition, things that they've learned in the past that are very important, and taking over of land, farming, livestock, things of that sort, things that we saw after World War II in Eastern Germany. These are the things that happened. And, of course, having a weapon was illegal. And I personally know of a story where after the war, some young man was seen bringing a weapon and spent 5 years in jail. And they'll try to pull that in America. And it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is. And there's a lot of weapons, and they're never going to get them all, and they know that. My guess is you'll probably get 1/3 of them. Those are the people who say, hey, I'm not going to fight with the government. You know, here's my hunting rifle. But there are others who are going to go underground. Probably literally with their weapons. But anyway, I think it's headed in the direction of violence, revolution. And the powers in play know that. And that's what they're preparing for. And that's what part of these rules are, to stop terrorists. The only problem is that, ladies and gentlemen, you're the terrorists.
Well, according to their definition, certainly, but of course we know that it's the exact opposite. But at any rate, you're unfortunately right that things are coming to a head, but I think probably the scariest idea is that the people don't end up revolting in some way, don't throw off the power shackles, and they end up with this type of totalitarian world government run by these technocrats who are literally talking about social engineering. That Scientific American article I cite goes on to talk about how the technical details of solving climate change are the easy part. It's the social engineering that's the killer. Moonshots and Manhattan projects are child's play compared to needed changes in the way we behave. And of course, we've seen them lusting after the ability to basically shape the public's will to their own will and try to make us into a subservient people who are just grazing off of grass and struggling for what we can. Well, of course, the technocrats live in their mansions because that's the best way to run society. But on a different or related note, of course, we see the building of a new power block to try to potentially counterbalance some of the hegemony that NATO has been exerting around the world. And we can pick this up from the Republic Radio of Armenia, which had a recent article, Eurosec Leaders Come Together in Moscow to Discuss Post-Soviet Integration, which notes the leaders of former Soviet republics making up a regional economic grouping, the Eurasian Economic Community, or Eurosec, led by Russia, will on Monday meet in Moscow to discuss prospects of integration processes, the Kremlin reported. And it goes on to talk about how the Interstate Council of Eurosec will be attended by the presidents of Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, as well as leaders of Armenia, Moldova, and Ukraine, which have observer status in the organization. So here we have yet another organization that's a type of emerging power bloc. And there are a few of them out there now with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and others that seem to be gaining steam as NATO seems to be gaining steam and trying for further and further domination in further flung parts of the globe. So, Bob, your take on this process and what we can likely see playing out now as Putin takes over the helm of Russia.
Again, this is the second time around.
The second time, yeah.
And he was elected with strong showing. So the people overall wanted him in office. They obviously liked what he did the first time around. But what you've talked about is very far-reaching. But it's natural. Nations want to do commerce. Russia, China, they want to do business with other people. So they form these pacts, and we're going to do business with one. This is the way we're going to do it. Secondarily is the geopolitical aspects, which are, well, if these people are doing business with us, in all likelihood, if we take a position on something that has nothing to do with commerce, there might be a good reason for them to follow us. And so what it is, a commercial political outreaching, geopolitical gathering. And, you know, some nations were captive to the Soviets. And, but they found, you know, in the years since the demise of the Soviet Union, that their former adversaries aren't that difficult to deal with. And, especially with Putin, he's certainly a heads up guy. There's not much he doesn't know about what goes on. I don't think he gets too much heat coming a common term, or we'll call it their House and Senate. His advisors for the power blocks within the Congress in Russia. But I think he has a fairly free hand, and these are guesses. This is observation and analysis. I don't see any other foreign leaders with that kind of a ability to be able to do the kind of things they can do somewhat on their own. And so I tend to look at the BRIC nations, but particularly Russia, in a positive way, because they're really doing the things they're supposed to be doing. I mean, they're not trying to rattle anybody's cage. And they had that mini war in, was it Armenia? Or I can't even remember now. It only lasted for about 2 weeks. They sent Russian forces in, and they just decimated the opposition.
In South Ossetia, and, in Georgia, yeah.
Right, Georgia, that was it. Georgia was the key. And they killed a lot of American and Israeli mercenaries. Hundreds and hundreds of them. So, he's not looking for trouble. And if Georgia wants to do what it wants to do, that's fine. But don't go in these two provinces, because they're under our influence. They culturally are very close to us. And if you do, we'll kick the crap out of you again. And if you notice, that whole thing simmered down because the Russians didn't back off. And I don't think they should have. And so I can't see anything wrong that they're doing. And so I think that influence that's spreading in those nations that you just mentioned and others, I think that's just fine. And if the United States and Great Britain and Europe want to start bombing Iran or somebody like that, let them do it. And you wake up tomorrow morning and there's a big hole in the ground where New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Miami used to be. Not that if the Russians had to do that, they would probably lose major cities as well. But the point is, they're not going to back up. And they're not stupid people. They're very devoted to their country, and they're very proud of their country, and they're very highly intelligent people. I know. I used to spy against them.
Indeed. Well, I can't disagree with you there. I think that certainly they definitely have their plans. And you're right to bring up that Georgian conflict back in 2008, because it's just an interesting little bit of history that unfortunately got swept under the rug very quickly, because Russia did respond so forcefully, and they had generals coming out on TV saying, well, we're prepared to move nukes into the area, and you saw the forces back down pretty quickly after that. And as you say, they really did decimate those Georgian forces quite quickly. So I think it was, to a certain extent, a test of Russia's resolve, and there's no doubt whatsoever that they have the resolve right now to defend those parts of the border that are being threatened by NATO and their allies, Saakashvili and all those cronies. So you're exactly right to point that out. I think it is an important point that unfortunately has been lost in the mix to a large extent. Probably it deserves a little bit more fleshing out. But let's change topics a little bit towards the end of the conversation here, and let's get an update on the gold and silver markets and what's been going on in the past week.
Well, I think gold and silver showed a firmness. They didn't run away and run to the upside. A good indicator were the shares. They were off a bit, around 6% on the week. But there was heavy pressure on gold and silver again because of what's going on in Europe. That's what this is all about. Europe's not fixed. Never will be fixed in the form that it is now. And so I think gold is building a base here for no other reason other than I don't think they want to take it below 1600 or thereabouts. And why do I say that? Because you get the Russians, Chinese, Brazil, Iran, India, standing there with big baskets, buying gold and silver at bargain basement prices. I mean, I know why they hold gold and silver down, but just how dumb are they? I mean, any gold that gets sold has got to be coming from the central banks on what they have left. So they can't go too far with this thing. Because in order to make it go further down, even though to a great extent the selling is being done in the paper market, futures and derivatives, but still somebody's got to deliver if somebody wants delivery. So I don't think they want it any lower. I think this for now is sufficient, probably until April. So we may have a run back up here to 1700 or 1800, and then we'll have the problem of Greece and its bills and all of this thing coming. You're going to have an election somewhere at the end of April, hopefully for the Greek people. There'll be all kinds of changes going on, and they'll probably have to suppress it again. But they can't keep on doing it because everybody knows what they're doing. And, of course, that's inhibiting investment in the bond markets and the stock markets. I mean, they've thrown tremendous amount of money, trillions and trillions, at the bond and stock markets, and they still are not at new, you know, giant highs. They're close to it. But you would have thought that that kind of investment would have engendered higher prices. And it hasn't. So I think you have naysayers in there who are saying, look, the earnings aren't there. They're down 50% from where they were. I don't see this as a bargain at all. Unbalanced volume says the market should be headed down. So to me, it's a difficult proposition. What do I mean by that? Sure, there's a lot of money to take them much higher. But will it work? Will the episode that's about to come in about a month and a half from now in relation to Greece, because it's not over, and Ireland's going to have a referendum, but I don't have a date on it. And the referendum probably will say, we're not going to pay the banks back the money that we said they were and take care of all their debts because we didn't make them, they did. And the politicians before us should have never made a deal like that. And that's really true. I mean, people are sold out. And so you're going to have that kind of a rocky year. But I think during the course of that year, we'll see gold go to 2,000 or 2,200. And I don't think, it's not, as long as something else bad isn't going on, I think they'll let it go up there. And that'll make some good gains, but it'll also make some very good gains in the shares, which are selling for next to nothing.
Well, certainly, as you indicated, it is going to be very topsy-turvy in the coming months. And of course, it will depend on all of the latest twists and turns that they try to throw at us. So it would probably be in everyone's best interests to be subscribed to a publication like the International Forecaster, which, of course, is keeping its eyes on U.S. markets and gold and silver and all sorts of other factors every single week. In fact, two times a week. So, Bob, why don't you tell people about the Forecaster and how people can get their hands on a copy?
Well, the forecast is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. Published on Wednesday and Saturday by email, running 35 to 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the internet. And everything that you need to know each week is in that publication. You can get a free introductory copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, forecaster.com. You can also go to www.intforecaster.com. intforecaster.com. And for those of you who would like to ask a question, get a copy, or get a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares, all you have to do is email us. Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com. Bob at intforecaster.com. And for those of you who want to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178. 477, that's incorrect. 877-479-8178. You can get copies there, and if you'd like to become a subscriber, it's a place to go to. They have an offering there of a full 1 year free subscription, and the offering, I think, that they are making is terrific. And if you want to become a subscriber, you should go there because it's a heck of a deal.
And in the interest of a little shameless self-promotion, let me remind the listeners out there that also the Corbett Report is listener-supported as well. So, of course, you can also subscribe to my much humbler once-a-month newsletter, which goes out to all my subscribers for as little as 100 Japanese yen a month. All the details are on CorbettReport.com. So, Bob Chapman, thank you again for your time. I'm looking forward to all of the latest news and information next week.
And I'm looking forward to being here.